The stones growled. A flake of quartz hit my cheek, and still I heard Gillian grinding the raw slabs of quartz together in the utter blackness. I stared hard into the nothingness before me, retina dancing with purple and yellow lines, luminal memory of life before we had closed the door. A glow of orange in the crack between the stones, gone. There was a pause. Gillian shifted her movements. The growl of rock increased in intensity. Then there were flickering lights in the dark, gold and blue phosphorescence. A universe of stars within orange nebulae, galaxies came and went, the fires of supernovae. The lights whirled faster, and the growl became a harsh ringing of quartz on quartz. There was no shadow in this world, nothing illuminated, only the effervescent glow of piezoelectrics, and finally, reaching my nostrils, the stench of burnt rock. The sound and light faded, and I heard footsteps echoing above us in the design studio. Gillian threw back the trapdoor, and spotlights blazed down on us. "That was fantastic," I said. "I know." Gillian was shaking out her arms after the exertion. The two flat quartz blocks lay on the floor, surrounded by chips and crystalline dust. "I take them along when I'm out visiting chambered tombs. It's really atmospheric when you're in pitch darkness, standing in 2 inches of water underneath the earth. Movement of the body is just so important to remembering. You're not going to forget rubbing those quartz blocks together now, are you? It's what we're trying to get at with the camera stone." We clambered out of the storeroom, and I saw that the weather was thick with unshed rain, dark and heavy clouds so close as to be almost touchable. The black boulders in the gravel and sands of the shoreland were damp with wind-whipped crests of waves, which crashed against their sides. The spray rose in clumps of water and then fell onto smooth stone surfaces to face the sky. Gillian had gone to the kitchen and leaned out of the doorway to make motions asking if I wanted a cup of cocoa. Behind, the studio door thudded open, and I heard the quietly intense voices of Richard and Georgina, the grandfather and grandmother figures in this small family of designers, artists and anthropologists. In this company, there were many passions, for family, for the sun that almost never set in summer and cast a perpetual twilight in winter, for the archaeological monuments whose standing stones rose from the surface of the fields, and a passion, today, for the futures of the mobile telecoms industry and, in particular, for the camera stone. Gillian passed me a hot chocolate and dodged around a pool of blankets at the end of her chaise longue to listen to their discussion. Richard was glancing furtively around the studio as he spoke, peering at the collages of magazine pages stuck irreverently to one side of the stone tower that lay at the fulcrum of the studio. They broke off as we came closer, and George smiled. "Good morning. We're just trying to work out how to get the industry to visit." Richard was blinking rapidly with thought. "The airport's been closed for 2 days this week. They're quite likely to get stranded down south, unable to fly," he noted. "So I do think it would be prudent if we go to them. Do a presentation at a hotel in Edinburgh. Yes, that would work out well." George was not taken with his acquiescence. "They just have to get here, Richard." She pursed her lips, ran a tense finger along the inside of her newspaper print scarf. "The islands are in love with the camera stone. Even my mother has one on pride of place on her mantelpiece, for goodness sake. I don't think they will get it unless they are here." She levelled an uncompromising stare at him. "Anne says it's become socially as well as technically embedded here on Orkney. You cannot just move it. They can only experience the camera stone here. It's that simple." Richard flustered slightly at her directness. Well, yes. Then he gave a conspiratorial smile. Actually, I don't think it will be a problem if we have them fly up from Edinburgh. It's an enticing place for them to wait until the clouds part, if there's a problem. Fine, George flicked her hand dismissively in agreement. She pushed her black-rimmed glasses up onto the top of her head, frowned as she noticed an oddly sculptured bronzed ball balancing on the edge of a worktop in front of the window. From its base, a tangle of ribbon cables thrashed their way uncomfortably towards the back of a PC tower. It was a camera stone, one of the prototypes. Carefully, I moved the ball and tried pushing the dial at the top, seeing if it would come to life. On the other five opposing sides, smooth, round bulges undulated my fingers as my hand flowed over its cool surface. Inside each bulge was a tiny LCD screen. "I think you'll need to rock it," suggested a quiet voice. It was Su Yin, hidden in a corner behind a bank of battered widescreen monitors. She leaned over and held out her hand, twisting it back and forth to show me. I let my finger slide into the cool gaps between the nodules where the screens were, then rocked the stone back and forth a few times. Then I bent to peer into the stone. There was a vision of a smooth mountain top seen from afar, scree slopes falling out of frame, moving. It was a video scene from a footpath, I wasn't sure. Then I looked into the other screens and saw the same mountain from the other four directions. One side had a long arete upon which people walked towards me. And then I looked above, and it was of a person I didn't know standing on the rocky summit of the mountain, Walker's Cairn and a white trig point nearby. It was beautiful. A landscape and a mountain caught within the scrying glass of the camera stone. I felt like I was looking back in time, or perhaps I was looking into the future. "Whatever is Simon up to now?" murmured George, breaking my reverie. "He's gone to the jewellers. They are engraving one of the models," said Su Yin. I went around the curve of her glass desk, and she carefully set aside her graphics tablet to face me. "Engraving a model?" I asked. "We gave them a 3D model from the first batch we produced." She nodded towards the drinks machine hulk of the 3D printer, used to print out in layers of models of the camera stone from her CAD data. They decided to electroplate the plastic to create a showpiece. They were getting their families to send in pictures and videos from their mobiles. They thought the camera stone was like a family photo frame, something that would hold images of friends and family together in one place. "A space, an artifact to hold social relations together," I murmured. She nodded. "Yes, I think so. They want to engrave their model with spiral motifs, like the prehistoric carved stone balls which we used as inspiration, but made very modern, very elegant." There was a dull thud. The door to the studio banged open again, coinciding with a boom of wind reverberating through the wall of window. The clouds had broken at last, and the raindrops unleashed upon us. "There you are!" It was Anne, our merry aunt. "Just off to see Mary, George's mother. She's been knitting with one of our camera stones. Did you want to join me?" I quickly downed as much of the rest of the hot chocolate as I could and leapt for the studio door, trying to remember quite where I'd left my boots. Were they in the airlock, or did I leave them at home by the radiator? Inside the enormity of the leaky Land Rover, high up over the stream of tarmac, Anne and I had a chance to catch up. She had been out of the office for much of the time in the past few weeks. "So how does Mary fit into this?" I asked, eyes on the grimy pool of rainwater collecting around my feet. "Has she really invited all the executives from the industry to hers for tea? I was somewhat sceptical. "That she has," Anne was all mischievous. She had been in cahoots with Mary and various others for weeks, initially as an anthropologist conducting her ethnography of photographic keepsakes and postcards, but now she had a whole network of people across the islands who had helped develop ideas for the prototype and then simply taken off with the concept, from jewellers to architects, from grandmothers to teenagers, each transforming the camera stone into something slightly different. "She is quite determined to give them a piece of her mind," Anne explained. We sailed on through the town of Kirkwall and south, road now almost Roman straight, a wet rope undulating over grassy fields that stretched away into the clouds all around us. Patches of rain filled the air, refused to fall, seemed simply to blow out of the clouds in gusts. But Anne confidently pushed through, welly pedal to the floor, elbows out. "Since we made that model with her family in it, she feels quite attached," she explained. "And I agree with her. You can't just take an empty model and a few PowerPoint slides and plant them in front of someone and expect them to feel anything. To really get it, well, I suppose some people would love the idea of the thing as a gadget, but I'm not very interested in them." A car passed on the other side, and Anne waved to the driver with a wide smile. "You want someone to fall in love with the whole thing," she continued. "And the whole thing includes where it is, and what it does, and who does what with it. You can't really hand-wave that stuff and say, 'Oh, teenagers will love it.' Ugh," she shook her head. "Which teenagers, where, doing what? And then you find that half of them hate the thing. It has happened to us, you know, when we've got a little carried away. Anyway, the camera stone is a future, which we've made into a plastic model. And we love it, as you know. But it turns out that other people love it, not for what it is, but for what they think it is. It's metamorphosed into lots of different futures, which is grand." I nodded, listening. Remembered that this had been George's concern, that you could not take those different futures and the families and people and experiences who had made them and crush their relationships into a PowerPoint slide. The industry had to visit the families and experience the camera stones as they existed in the lives of the people who had made them in part. It seemed the camera stone had metamorphosed wildly. You could not simply have a boardroom demo of the technological prototype and say that was the whole thing. If anything, through Anne's work, the future that the camera stone embodied had become locally adaptive, mutable. The plastic camera stone model was part technical, part social, part imaginary. A future object that did not hold still as it moved and multiplied. Rather, it shifted unpredictably in response to changing local circumstances. It was a fluid technology. I put the idea to Anne, and she agreed. "Aye, we're not interested in creating one thing. If we can create something that's amenable to being loved and adopted..." "And adapted," I added. "Yes, and adapted, then that's far better. It's about durability." That caught me, and I looked across at her sharply. "If you want something to endure," she explained, "and if you want it to settle in all sorts of varied places, then you have to make it amenable to decay and fragmentation." She shrugged, eyes to the rear-view mirror, turning the wheel to miss a pothole. "I've always thought you can't design a universal technology. You can only really design something to be part of somewhere, that can be made to fit in with a little effort." And she leaned over to me with a little dimple in her cheeks. "Nothing works out of the box. It's all social and technical practice. That's why I push for social as well as technical design, not to fix either in stone," she gave a cackle at her inadvertent reference, "but to try and make some space for them in a terribly practical, possible, no-nonsense way. It's the internet in Trinidad argument. The internet is not global, but always part of local practices. It's always local stuff." And that was why we were driving to Mary's, George's mother, to see what the camera stone had become in her particular life. We finally rose the crest of a long hill and tumbled down a rutted lane towards a grey cottage nestled above a brushstroke of white beech. The clouds had upturned and risen, broken even in places, so that glimpses of blue vaults pooled overhead. In the distance, below the mist-enshrouded twin mountains of Hoy, a red dash of oil tankers divided a tousled sea. "I recommend you hang on to your door," advised Anne, as she took firm hold of her own, ready to pull against the gusting late summer gale. Mary's front room was a dark, traditional affair of Queen Anne armchairs, lace, and side tables filled with sponge cake and china teacups. An open fire glowed with intense warmth behind the mesh of a fire guard, forming a yellow grid that danced over the fiercely condensed black eyes of our elderly host. As we tucked into the obligatory tea and cake, Mary leaned over to her small collection of ornamental figures on her mantelpiece and took up what looked like a pale lavender ball covered with knitted flowers in thickly woven crochet. Green vines enveloped the ball between the flowers, almost growing out from neat holes on six bulging sides. It was the camera stone. Mary caressed it briefly and then gave it a series of shakes, knuckles white with the stiff, firm movements. "Isn't that what you said, Anne?" she said, stopping suddenly mid-motion. "Shake it every day, or before you want to look inside, to keep the lights on." "Oh, yes," agreed Anne, watching carefully over the thin rim of her teacup. I knew that it was this kinetic powering that Simon had calculated would keep the backlights for the camera stone's five tiny screens alight, and in theory could provide enough charge to enable the imaging chips to take pictures and video footage, and even run the wireless Bluetooth port. "It helps me with my arthritis," added Mary, flexing her paper-white skin stretched thinly over engorged knuckles. "The nurse says I'm supposed to fiddle with some funny little ball, but doing this at least has some purpose." She turned her black eyes to Anne, intent. "I'm in training for the real thing, you know, and Kathy's doing the same for her joints, so you'd better get those people over here soon and get them to make a real one." Anne glanced at me. "I think that adds therapeutic device to the list of unexpected possibilities." Mary peered into one of the knitted holes, then slowly rotated the camera stone, staring at the other five sides. "I do like this picture of Georgina. Front, back, left, right, and that strange view of the top of her head," she said. "Although I cannot imagine how you persuaded her to step in front of the cameras. I would love to experience it properly one day, rather than these peedy postage stamps here. I'll tell that to those executives, too." She pulled a piece of fluff from an intricately knotted crocheted leaf and passed it to Anne. "I've been busy with my needles, you know," she explained. "I made amber an olive green cover. Grunge, I think she called it. And Kathy wanted one in cerise. Once you make this little stone properly, I think I might set up a knitting business." She took back the beautiful ball of yarn. "I couldn't possibly have it on my mantelpiece without that cover." She flashed a hard stare at Anne. "You be careful, those technology people. They'll end up making something all steel and black with hundreds of buttons." She reached over to a side table with an embroidered lace tablecloth, a large plain cream telephone, and picked up a silver mobile phone. "Like this?" We returned to the grass-covered dome of Sand 14, an obsequious mound by the loch. I turned and looked back across the road to Sand 14's architectural counterpart, the grassy curve of a 5,000-year-old prehistoric passage grave in the field beyond. In 1,000 years, would they both be the past dreams of archaeologists, I wondered. We headed back into the studio. Through the stone slits of the square house at the core of the dome, We could hear Richard and George still in conversation and followed their voices into the house. The peat fire burnished the air, and immediately the chill dampness, the clamour of wet weather, left me. Surprisingly, Amber was there, her long, tall limbs folded cross-legged on a chair. She and her partner, who were clean-up and facilities, usually only dropped by between college classes. During this particular project, however, Amber's alter ego as a local DJ had been extensively co-opted. She was cradling a white plastic camera stone model covered with words, graffiti and signatures. "It was my last day and it was just in my bag, so everyone ended up signing it," she explained, turning it in her hands, protective. "I had a load of pics on my phone and Simon suggested printing them out and pasting them onto the windows of the stone. He said you'd be able to do that, send pics from my phone and back again." She squinted into one of the five extrusions that were both viewfinder and digital display. Inside the rounded square was a small picture of two bright faces. Anne was nodding intently, then asked, "Will you keep it?" Amber looked shocked. "Yeah, of course. I'll probably delete the pics on my phone, but I wanted to keep this as a memento of the day." She paused, reticent for a moment. "Can I have another one to take to college? Don't you just push a button on that 3D printer thing?" It was only then that I realised that the spheroid models were not simply concepts, but were seeds for future concepts. Seeds over which Sand 14 demanded little ownership or possession. Amber left for college, and Gillian, Simon, and Su Yin joined us for lunch. As we made a sterling effort to polish off wedges of home-baked flapjack, George continued with her concerns for their communication of the camera stone to industry. "I just don't know how we're going to explain our approach," she worried, spooning out the residual crema of her espresso. Richard leaned back. "We need to communicate our approach to the future. There's a crucial difference between predictions and forecasts that foreclose the future and possibilities that make the future volatile and unpredictable. Our approach is about creating local and multiple futures. I think we can contrast that with the utopian ideal of the mobile telecoms industry. They call it anywhere, anytime, a global mobile network. I think that makes it very clear. Yes, let's frame it as the difference between well-rehearsed, comfortable, ubiquitous futures and uncomfortable, unpredictable local futures." George spoke again. "We still have to persuade them to come here." "Yes, well, I had an idea about that." Richard's fingers were wavering again. "I think that a side trip to our prehistoric counterpart over the road might be useful." George raised her eyebrows sharply. "Why?" But it was Anne who leapt in to reply. "The passage grave is aligned on the midwinter sunset," she said excitedly, head rolling back, eyes skyward, imagination soaring. "It's the only time of the year when the sunlight travels down the passageway and into the inner chamber. It's a fine example of a local technology. You cannot just move Maze Howe and rebuild it the same way somewhere else. It has to be there, in that location. Otherwise the sun doesn't rise over the mountains in the right place. If you move it, you'd have to change its architecture. The monument and the landscape are irreducible. The technology of the monument is inseparable from its locale." "Ah, oh, it's a fine idea, Richard. Tempt them with our local archaeology." There was silence. The unspoken question. Would they be tempted? Would they come and experience the multitude of well-loved futures that was the camera stone? And perhaps more importantly, would they fall in love with it too and take it home with them? I suddenly realized that if they were going to use solar technology, and the sun was such an integral part of life here on Orkney, then they also ought to use their long starlit nights. It would be dark for most of the day during the winter, I knew. So I made a suggestion. You might want to throw a firework party too if it's going to be midwinter. George frowned for a moment, then nodded. You're probably right. We'll need lots of fireworks. They look quite stunning from here, reflected in the loch. And lots of fire, burning torches, perhaps a torch procession leaving here to go to Maze Howe. The skin around the edge of my skull, just above my ears, tingled with the thought, with simply the vision of people carrying torches out from this grass dome of Sand 14, up out of the basin to the prehistoric mound of Maze Howe, its golden entranceway drawing us on in the glimmering sunset, torchlight flickering over faces, changing faces, weaving with the long shadows of the endless twilight of an Orcadian winter. A few weeks later, Gillian showed me their invitation for the workshop, an invitation for the mobile telecoms industry to experience different places and different futures. They had begun to plan a series of sites in which the models of the camera stone would be working, visits to people who had used one and had wanted to talk about their experiences. Anne's intention was for the industry visitors to almost stumble onto the camera stone, for they would have some of the more elaborately graved and textured models in glass cases in shop fronts and at the mill nearby, where the visitors would stop for a tour of Maze Howe. Anne had enlisted the enthusiastic aid of people and businesses all over the islands who had definite thoughts on the uses for the camera stone in their lives. I worried for a while at how those in the industry might react to the social and technical approach of the design of the concept, and to the extraordinary concept itself, until I heard Richard give a whoop of delight one day. He bounded down the spiral staircase from the mezzanine floor and crashed into the kitchen table. "I've just spoken to a marketing manager at one of the big mobile manufacturers," he said, hopping with sheer energy from foot to foot. "And he said in passing to me, we should do something like that." So the effects began, and the winter solstice workshop of Sand 14 was yet to come.